but enough. Across the lower reaches of the monastery, a few pockets managed to barricade themselves behind doors, or shut themselves off from the red tide. That was when the first fires were set. Slick with blood and with the fingers, tongues, and ears of the dead hanging off them, the pilgrims left those they could not butcher to the flames. Beneath the wide arch of the nine suns, the rising tide met their first true resistance. 40 shrine guard, marshalled by an Adeptus Arbites proctor, met the first pilgrims to try to force their way through. Mismatched stubbers and black powder pistols fired ragged volleys into the charging horde. Dozens fell. Those behind them did not pause, but scrabbled over the dead to die in turn. For a while, it looked as though the arch might hold. Then a thing the size of a grox swayed and wobbled to the front of the throng. Bullets plucked at its red shroud. It cried out in dozens of voices, each one a shriek of pain and anger. Some of the shrine guard ran, then. Those that stood and fired lived long enough to see the bloated thing stop and raise a tiny head on a long neck. It breathed out. Black flies filled the air and poured over the defenders, shredding them with a million bites as the bloated host of the swarm deflated with a final cry. On they came, the denied, hopeless and forsaken, and if there was any space for mercy in their hearts, they showed none.
"Hold!" said Covenant.
Behind him, the arbitrator squads dropped into low firing positions. Coleg saw the wind speed increase in the corner of his visor. Snow was spiraling across the sky, around the bridge and between the towers rising above them. There was no balustrade to the bridge, just a sheer drop down to the lower roofs and tower tops of the monastery. A foot of snow had already covered the stone slabs of the bridge. Coleg holstered his macro-stubber pistol and considered the view in front of them. It was called the Bridge of Absolution, and it linked a bastion of the eastern cloister to a tower that rose from the ruined heap of the burnt shrines. According to the lean-faced abbot and his hard-eyed assistant, this bridge would allow access to the main bulk of the inner cloisters without going through the miles of corridors and doors of the monastery itself. Doors could be sealed at the bridge's end, but doors could be broken, and Covenant had decided to move himself and three squads of arbitrators to it while Orsino oversaw the securing of other key points, staunching the mass of pilgrims that had begun to flow into the cloisters from the drift. The reason was simple, and Coleg knew it with a soldier's clarity and without needing to be told. The Inquisitor wanted to see this enemy, to face it down and break some of its momentum. That was why he had ordered Coleg to come with him, because this was going to be about killing. Coleg pulled his grenade launcher around from the small of his back. The wind speed would make using it difficult.
"Negative on targets by movement, heat and light, my lord," said one of the arbitrators.
"They will come," said Covenant.
Coleg saw his master look down at a small device of brass and spinning crystal. Then he replaced it in a pouch and nodded to the dark end of the bridge beyond the falling snow.
"Movement! 300 meters front!"
Coleg's visor zoomed in. He saw it then, a staggering shape, hunched and blurred by rags. Coleg clicked his visor to infrasight. The world became blue with cold. He looked at the figures walking towards them on the far side of the bridge. For a second, they were cold blue smudges against the black.
"Confirm hostiles," said one of the arbitrators.
The advancing figures flared white with heat. Coleg clicked back to normal vision. The falling snow froze in midair. Red rags burned on the nearest figures. Ash spiraled up into the night sky. The bodies beneath were hunger-thin, stitched and cut with scar patterns. Hooks had been bound in place of their hands, and their lower jaws torn free of their heads. The first steps they took were unsteady on the iced stone, but then they changed. Heat poured out of their wounds and eyes, flesh charred and elongated, growing even as it cooked. Horns and quills and hooves pushed through their skin. They blurred with speed, limbs stretching as they uncoiled into a run.
"Hostiles confirmed," called Coleg, and fired.
The grenade punched out of the launcher with a dull thump. The wind yanked it, but Koleg had accounted for its shear. The grenade struck the bridge just in front of the charging creatures. Splintered stone and shrapnel flew out, then slowed, spinning in the dark like snow caught in a breeze. The arbitrators opened fire. Shots ripped out, overlapping, hammering into the creatures as they came forwards. The clouds of shot burned as they flew. Hundreds of steel spheres became a glowing cloud. The creatures did not slow down, but ran on. Molten shot punched into them. Koleg switched the setting on his grenade launcher and pulled the trigger twice. The two grav bombs hit the two closest creatures with enough force to make them stagger. The compact gravitic generators in each grenade triggered a second later. The creatures slammed down into the bridge. Bones broke. Burning flesh was crushed to ash and jellied meat. The creatures behind them dropped to all fours and scuttled over the side of the bridge. And behind them, more were coming. Even inside his mask, Koleg could taste ash and burning hair.
"Forward!"
said Covenant, and stepped to meet the burning creatures. He had drawn his sword, and its field lit with a growl of static. Snowflakes exploded to steam as they kissed the power field. The nearest creature leapt at them. In shape, it looked like a canid fused with an unfeathered bird, back-jointed, long-limbed, blood drooling from the maw that had split wide down its chest. The features of its human host remained only in the terror of its eyes as it leapt towards Covenant, hooked arms raised. The psi cannon on Covenant's shoulder rotated up and fired. Its round punched into the creature's chest and exploded. Sacred silver and grave dust gathered from executed witches ripped through its flesh. The thing screamed as it fell, and Covenant was moving, sword rising to take the next one as it leapt. Koleg swung his grenade launcher onto his back and drew his macro-stubber pistol. He pulled the trigger as the gun came free. Micro-rounds, each no wider than a needle, hosed into the horde of creatures rolling up the bridge. Limbs and torsos came apart. Shotgun fire was lashing into them from the arbitrators. The creatures shrieked, and the tide of them parted over the edge of the bridge as they scuttled onto its underside like spiders.
"Look to the flanks!" shouted one of the arbitrators.
Covenant paused as more creatures swarmed into the space left by his latest kill. Cords of ghostlight gathered around his temples. A thing with a mouth as wide as its chest jumped forward, black teeth sharp in a hungry smile. A wall of invisible force slammed out from Covenant. The creature flew backwards, limbs and skin torn off as it struck those behind it. The wall of telekinetic force ripped onwards, throwing bodies into the air and tearing others to red shreds. Koleg moved up to Covenant's side, firing without pause. The barrel of his pistol was glowing. Covenant struck a creature with an overhead blow and split it from head to crotch in a shriek of lightning. The psi cannon on his shoulder spun and fired behind them as the first creature came up over the side of the bridge. The psi active round ripped its elongating skull off and sent its corpse pitching back into the dark drop, down to the roofs and spires below. The macro-stubber clicked empty in Koleg's hand. Limbs and torn flesh carpeted the stone in front of them. A thing with bloody stumps for legs thrashed a clawed hand at him from a pile of flesh. He kicked it back, stripped the glowing barrel and empty cylinder mag from the pistol, drew replacements from his harness, snapped them into place, and kept shooting. A fresh wave of figures was surging up the bridge. Red rags hung from them, and blades glinted in their hands. The creatures were clawing up onto the bridge around and behind Covenant's arbitrators. An arbitrator spun his shotgun around as a thing that had been human and was now a mass of tentacles and stingers flopped over the parapet next to him. He fired as a barbed tentacle whipped out and smashed through his visor in a spray of mirror glass and bone. Koleg stitched a line through the thing's main mass. Mouths opened in its skin, yellow human teeth around red tongues, and howled in human voices. Covenant turned, spun his sword so that it was point down in his hands, and plunged it into one of the open mouths. The creature split, tentacles thrashing as Covenant ripped the sword free and kicked it off the edge. Koleg's sword macro-stubber fire across the figures charging up the slope of the bridge. Shot blasts ripped through them. Inside his skull, he watched the rag-wrapped people fall. He saw their faces in the muzzle flare, men and women, strong and weak. He heard the hate pouring from their lips, and the bloody spray up, black in the flash and roar. He noted how old some were, how weak some seemed, how their eyes were still human behind their masks and still bloody scars. He saw all this and felt nothing.
"More are coming, Lord,"
he called to Covenant. The Inquisitor paused, but did not look at the horde. He was lifting the device from the pouch at his waist again, and it caught the battle's light. The psi-cannon on his shoulder twitched, spitting rounds into warped creatures and the charging throng alike. Koleg glanced at his master as he reloaded again, then looked closer at the brass instrument he held. Spheres of crystal were spinning at its heart, and Koleg could see light gathering and scattering as they whirled faster and faster. Covenant's eyes were fixed on it, staring, while around him fire and blood touched the cold dark. Koleg flicked his attention back to the space beyond the muzzle of his gun as one of the arbitrators shouted. The crowd of figures swarming up the bridge was draining back, leaving the dead and dying like flotsam on a shore. As swift as smoke blown by the wind, they were gone. The firing slowed and then ceased.
"What is this?"
hissed one of the arbitrators. The wind breathed into the silence. The arbitrators began to reload and pull their casualties back. Covenant was still looking at the brass disc in his right hand, his sword, still skinned with lightning, held low in his other hand.
"Lord," called one of the arbitrators, "are we withdrawing?"
Covenant looked up, blinked once, and replaced the brass disc in a pouch. The sword's power field snapped off, and he sheathed it over his shoulder as he turned and began to stride back towards the end of the bridge that connected to the inner cloisters.
"Remain," he said to the arbitrators as he moved through them. "Hold until you can't, and then pull back to the inner door."
Koleg followed him, falling in at his side in silence. Covenant looked at him, face set.
"It is coming," he said.
"Down!" hissed Agata. Joseph gritted his teeth as fresh pain jolted through him when he dropped behind a pile of snow-covered debris. Gold and the two arbitrators that were still with them flattened themselves into shadows amongst the tangle of ramshackle buildings. They had lost the other two in the time that it had taken them to get from the attack site to wherever they were. Somewhere deep in the western drift, he knew that much, but he had slipped out of consciousness a few times. The second time he had dimmed out, he had woken to find one of the arbitrators gone. He had asked what had happened.
"Wounds,"
Agata had said, and left it at that. She had talked less and less the further they went. He had walked using his hammer, or one of the arbitrators, for support, but then the pain would begin to rise, and Agata would loop herself under his arm and drag him on. Now, slumped in the deepening snow, he mouthed a prayer to the living God that he had tried to serve as best he could. Agata put a hand on his shoulder. He lifted his head and looked in the direction she pointed. A shape was moving across the open space of a snow-choked road in front of them. It was very tall and thin, its features hidden in a swathe of torn cloth. It reminded him of a street festival he had once seen on Scorboza. It had been the day of rising in the mortuary cities, and pairs of acrobats had stalked the streets on stilts, one balancing on the shoulders of the other, wearing costumes of dead saints with fireworks for eyes. The way they moved and swayed filled his mind as he watched the tall figure pause in the middle of the road. It turned its head. The shadow beneath its hood passed over where Joseph and Agata lay. For a moment he felt heat prickle his skin, and then the thing's gaze turned away and it swayed off down the street.
"Abomination," breathed Agata.
"Red pilgrims," said Joseph.
They had seen fewer and fewer of the red-swathed cultists as they had gone deeper into the drift, but then they had seen no sign of anyone else. Anyone living, at least. The dead were there in abundance. They found the first plague house off a rough square amongst the warren of alleys. The bodies had been heaped in a single structure, stacked like wood for winter. promethium slurry had been poured over them. They were going to burn them once there were enough. The bodies had been thin, and all of them had red welts and blisters on one of their hands, as though they had dipped their hand in whatever had killed them. They had found some evidence of what had happened to the rest in some of the shacks they had looked in. Only the wind and cold stopped the reek filling the air like a fog.
"Have you wondered?" began Joseph.
Agata had begun to rise and paused.
"What?" "We need to move. That thing might come back, and there might be others. We need to start arcing around towards the monastery."
Joseph shook his head.
"How long has there been plague in this place?"
"Weeks, maybe," she hissed. "Food has been scarce, and the orders have been coming out less to minister to the pilgrims. Disease followed in those footsteps."
"Enough to kill all those that this uprising did not?"
Agata paused, then shook her head. He noticed that a fresh runnel of blood had seeped from a ragged hole in the knee joint of her armor.
"There is no time to—
"Think, sister. This is a malefic uprising, one of the swiftest I have seen. If the rest of those in this drift did not die of the plague, or hunger, or cold, then they must be with them. They are all red pilgrims now."
"But how could so many fall so quickly?"
"I don't know, but it's a good question, don't you think?"
He watched Agata. The wrinkles and lines on her face deepened as she closed her eyes for a second. He saw the muscle tense in her jaw.
"You have an idea of how to find an answer?"
"Yes. I think we stop running and start hunting."
"You think that it is out here still?"
He pulled himself up so that he could point in the direction that the tall stalker in red had gone.
"I don't know. I doubt, though, that thing is simply wandering. I think it is guarding something. Something close."
"And so?"
"We follow it," he said,
pushing himself up with his hammer's haft. He closed his eyes for an instant and breathed to stop himself swaying, and then took a step through the snow.
"We follow it."
"Water!"
Iacto looked up from the sheaf of parchments he had spread across an upturned pew that had been used as a table.
"Yes, you, Abbot, in tracto, or whatever they said you were called. I need water, yes? You have enough grasp of both language and thirst to comprehend me?"
The old man in green robes had been sitting on a wooden bench 5 paces behind where Iacto was working. He had been there ever since the abbot had entered the room, but had not moved or spoken. He had just sat there, head bowed, shivering to whatever dreams passed through his sleep, claw-like hands hugging his robe to his chest. Iacto straightened and looked around. Apart from Glavius IV and the statue-like presence of 4 arbitrators, he was alone. All of the others had gone or withdrawn to other tasks. One of the arbitrators had dragged Saul's body away and sluiced the blood with snowmelt water. Pink-tinted ice crystals still floated on the puddle. He had sent Claudia to coordinate the search of the archives for the type of information the Inquisitor wanted. He could have gone himself, but he had decided to stay in the House of Concordance. There were 2 reasons for that choice. First was the simple fact that his instinct said that this was the safest place for him to be at the moment. The second was that he had begun to suspect that there were opportunities lurking just under the surface of what was happening. When he had stopped being shocked, he had started to see that, for all the horror and terror of what was happening, there were 2 possibilities. Either everything was going to end, or something was going to survive, but regardless of which, there was going to be chaos. And in chaos, there was a chance to take what before might have been out of reach. He just needed to wait and discover how to seize it.
"Are you an idiot?" asked the old man in green. "Water! Now, it's a very simple request and should not tax your faculties."
Iacto blinked, then nodded. There was a copper ewer of water on the floor nearby, and he poured a half measure into a wooden cup. The old man took it from him, sniffed, and thrust it back.
What do you think I am? Some dying old fossil who can only sip a thimble's worth? Full cup, man, full cup!
Iacto bit back the retort on his tongue and went to fill the cup.
My infinite thanks and blessings, said the old man, slurping the water down.
You are an astropath, said Iacto, watching drops of water fall from the old man's mouth to spot the green silk of his robes.
Observant as well as stupid. How novel!
Iacto was about to stop himself from shaking his head. Then he remembered that the old man was blind.
No need to spare my delicate feelings. I don't need to see you shake your head to see you shake your head.
The astropath smacked his lips as he drained the last of the water.
I am a witch, remember, with powers beyond that which the mundane can comprehend.
The old man smiled. Then he coughed, swayed, and vomited a mixture of water, bile, and blood onto the floor. Iacto flinched forward, but the old man raised a hand.
No, please spare me whatever passes for your sympathy.
He coughed and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
This place, it's still growing. Emperor of all, but we can't wait much longer.
Iacto frowned.
What are you talking about?
Matters beyond your understanding.
Is it something about the uprising? About these red pilgrims?
The old man chuckled.
Oh, great glory! You have no idea. I just wish that he could have left me out of it.
An idea formed in Iacto's mind. He glanced around, but the arbitrators had not moved. He looked back at the stacks of parchment and ledgers. He looked back at the astropath, and the idea became a question.
Astropaths send and receive messages across space. It makes sense that a man of such power would want to send and receive word of...
Ah, said the old man, looking uncomfortable. Not as stupid as you seem, then. My mistake.
Astropaths, said Iacto, suddenly cold as the last pieces of realization dropped into place. There is no astropath in the monastery. That is why the Inquisitor brought you, because there is no means of getting word out. There is no way that anyone could know what is happening.
He looked at the old man, but the old astropath did not move or reply.
But he came here, and he is fighting and sending others to fight. Why? Why did he come with so many troops if he did not know that this uprising was happening?
He had gone still, his mind dancing as he saw pieces of the situation afresh. He had not been thinking or seeing clearly before. There had been too much shock, too much fear. But now the truth seemed obvious.
He came here for something else, he said to himself. The only reason he is fighting what is happening is to buy time while he finds it.
You know, ideas and questions around the Inquisition tend to be bad ideas.
The old man held out the empty water cup.
Please, could you pour me some more water?
Iacto barely heard. He was moving towards one of the exits from the chamber. The arbitrator guarding it pulled it open and covered the area outside. He had been right, but not in the way he had expected. Times of greatest chaos were times of greatest opportunity. Behind him, as he hurried into the candlelit gloom of the cloister passages, he heard the old man's voice rise.
What about my water? I even said please.
Memnon stopped in the lee of a half-collapsed wall and looked up at the northern face of the monastery. Its windows were pale specks behind the falling snow. Gerdon paused at his side, rotating her head like a dog. The machines haloing her hissed and beeped.
High levels of etheric fracturing at play. The Neverborn are walking the world.
The towering form of Sinis shifted beside them. He alone had not taken the opportunity to get out of the wind.
Is an alignment forming? Asked Memnon.
I cannot tell. The data from atmospherics to etherics is fluctuating. I am, though, detecting vox communications. Primitive, but steady. There is coding, but some fragments are clear. I might...
She fell silent. Memnon looked at her.
What?
There is an uprising underway. It is flowing from the outer pilgrim areas. It is not clear, but there are indications that it is malefic in nature.
Memnon was still for a second, and then nodded. The threads draw tighter. He took the pouch of dust from under his fur-lined cloak and gave a pinch to the wind. The dust blew, all but invisible in the dark and storm. Then the mist of dust caught the faint hint of light from the monastery high above and gleamed for a second. Memnon looked at the space it had occupied, even after it had gone. Then he was up and moving towards the mountain of buildings. Sinis followed, catching up with the wanderer after only two strides. The auto sled lurched after them on its wide tracks and skids. Geddon scrambled in its wake, panting with effort. They were walking through snow by the time they reached the rock wall at the root of the monastery. Here there were none of the shanty drifts that clung to the monastery's southern and western edges. Some had once tried, but the ruins that Memnon and his companions had sheltered in were all that remained of that attempt. The wind howled over the mountains and beat against the northern walls where they met the rock that had been the root of the first cloisters and shrines. No one came here. Even in the season of sun, it was a bare desolation. Memnon stopped as he reached the ice-covered cliff face. Above him, the bare rock rose for 30 meters before meeting the first stone of the great structure. Geddon reached him as he was moving along the wall. He had a small glow globe in his hand and held it close to the rock face as he moved. Under its light, the ice and frost shone red and harsh white.
"There is a way in,"
panted Geddon, almost collapsing against the rock face.
"There is," said Memnon. "So much is forgotten, so much lost."
"You have been here before?" asked Geddon.
"I have," he said, pausing by a frost-cake section of rock. "Years ago. This place has been in my concerns and the concerns of our greater endeavors before."
He paused, his hand over a crack, and then thrust his gloved fingers into the jagged gap.
"I know," said Geddon, "but I thought that the experiment with the 10th path was confined to the Crow Complex."
Memnon pulled at something out of sight, and a section of rock hinged away from the cliff face. A narrow opening burrowed into the cliff beyond. Memnon held the red globe out, and its light caught the edges of dust-covered steps.
"The 10th path were placed on this planet because it is significant. The auguries have drawn us here many times. It is a crucible. Events, perhaps many, perhaps one, will occur here that contribute to the end we seek. That is why we were here before."
He tapped the surface of the red sphere, and it shone with bright, cold light which filled the rock-hewn passage.
"That is why we are here now."
They climbed the steps, up into the underbelly of the great monastery above. Here, down in the stone root of the structure, the air was warm from the geothermal exchangers sunk into Dominicus Prime's crust. Both Memnon and Geddon shed their furs, stowing them in the auto sled and taking equipment from the machine's storage compartments. It would remain inside the entrance to the passage. Only Sinis kept his heavy cloak, his head covered by the fur-lined hood, even as it got warmer and warmer. After a while, rock gave way to crumbling blocks, and bricks skimmed with crumbling plaster. The gaudy faces of angels watched them pass, their features cracked and fading. The narrow stairs and passages branched and threaded through spaces that were thick with dust. Only the sound of their steps and the buzz and hiss of Geddon's sensor arrays disturbed the silence. They began to pass through doors. Most were wooden, banded with metal, but some were inches thick iron and locked with bolts driven by cogs and gears. But Memnon passed through every door, sometimes with a key, sometimes with a touch.
Master!
Geddon broke the long silence as they approached a crumbling arch closed by a door of black wood beams and corroded steel. Memnon stopped. What have you sensed? He asked.
Beyond this door, multiple heat and motion indicators, consistent with a large number of people. From the vibrations in the floor, I would guess that they are climbing a wide set of stairs from some other part of the sublevels.
This is the only way, he said. We must pass.
That's not all, said Geddon.
The Auspex arrays on her skull fuming coolant gas from nostril-like openings.
Etheric indicators are rising.
A set of bulbous, fluid-filled lenses extended from her back on a set of calipers and dropped over her left eye. She raised her head and squinted at the door. The fluid in the lenses bobbled and became a luminous indigo.
There are never born on the threshold, she said.
Memnon looked at the doors for a second.
On the path of truth, the pure and just must pass through the place of serpents, he whispered to himself.
He turned to Sinis. The tall figure raised his hooded head. Memnon nodded. Sinis moved forward to the doors. A thick iron bar lay across them. Sinis raised his left arm. His fur cloak fell back from a tattooed muscle. The words and symbols branded and inked across the skin drained light from the air. He gripped the bar and lifted it free of its brackets. It clanged like a struck bell as it hit the floor. Sinis pushed the doors open. A paved landing between two flights of steep stairs lay beyond. Figures in red filled the steps and landing. Some of them stopped their descent as the door opened. A few held torches. Others were leading two figures held in webs of heavy chain. Iron bridles circled their skulls. Dried blood ran from black shards of metal hammered into their muscle. Signs had been cut into them. Their skin bulged, sinuous shapes moving beneath. Their hands had been severed and replaced with blades, hooks, and lengths of spiked chain. Their heads jerked up as Sinis took a single step forwards. The red throng turned. Knives, blades, and cleavers slid into hands. The chained figures hissed. The cloak dropped from Sinis's shoulders. Beneath, he was bare to the waist. Words and symbols covered every inch of skin. Jagged marks overlapped with circles, pentacles, and words written in languages dreamed by those that had thought they talked to angels. Some marks were scars or brands, others inked in grey pigment mixed from pyre soot and holy water. Muscle boost and stim injector plugs ran down his spine. The red figures charged, bare feet slapped on stone. Sinis drew the sickle from his waist. Its blade was a wide crescent of black metal. He gripped its double-handed haft and swung. Runes blazed with furnace heat along the cutting edge. The air screamed. Ghostlight dragged in the sickle's wake. The marks on Sinis's arms and hands wept blood. The sickle cut the first pilgrim from hip to shoulder. Blood burned to smoke. Flesh and bone crumbled to ash. The charging pilgrims faltered, but Sinis was moving and cutting, his shape stuttering with speed as the sickle blade howled. The runes of its edge were white with heat, twisting into images of teeth, mouths, and eyes. One of the chained figures yanked free of its handlers. The neverborn creature within its flesh howled as it sensed the sickle's thirst. More pilgrims were pouring down the stairs, but Sinis was a shadow blur now, prayers of hate and repentance hissing from his lips. The other chained figure snapped free of its bonds. Its head burst through its iron bridle, jaw elongating, molten iron drooling from its teeth. It bounded forwards, yanking the handler gripping its last chain into a wall with a wet crack. The sickle in Sinis's hand twitched to meet the creature as it pounced. The demon within the creature was fast and hungry, and driven by hate. But the blade in the sin-marked warrior's hand was old and spiteful, and its hate was a white star to the creature's candle. It met the creature's neck and cut the head free with a sigh. The skull fell, shedding burning flesh and twisted iron. A sound like metal on glass shivered in the air. Sinis did not pause. Within 20 heartbeats, there was a silence on the stairway. Sinis knelt amongst the remains. The sickle glowed in his grip. Whispers and shreds of laughter hissed in the air as Memnon walked from the door.
Of these sins that you have done, and of the corruption you bear, you are absolved, he said, placing his palm on Sinis's bowed head. The warrior shivered. In the name of him on terror.
He removed his hand, and the sacred giant stood, fastening the sickle to his waist. The heat of its runes were fading as the demon within its metal sank into its cold core. Memnon began to climb the steps. Sinis was about to follow when he noticed Gedn at his side. The hunched or spectra held out the warrior's cloak.
Yours,
she said. He looked at her for a second, then nodded once and took the cloak. Gedn started after Memnon. Sinis draped the cloak over himself and followed.
Down!
Gold hissed the word. Joseph pressed against the alley wall. He was not feeling cold anymore. He was not feeling much of anything. That was not good. Gold and the other arbitrator had slid into cover, their shotguns held tight. Agata dropped to one knee next to him. They were working their way down a twisting alley, keeping the stilt-legged creature in sight, trying to keep it downwind. It was not moving quickly, and its sight was not keen, but Joseph had a nasty feeling it might have more senses than the mundane five. It paused 50 paces in front of them. Its body became still, its hooded head moving slowly from side to side.
Do you see that?
Whispered Agata. Joseph glanced at her and shook his head. She had put her helmet back on as they attracted the stilt-walker creature. With the augmented sight of her armor, she could see better than any of them.
There, just behind it.
Joseph looked, but could see nothing. The snow covering the buildings and ground gathered and reflected what sparse light there was, but the world was still shrouded in night.
Sir,
hissed Gald, and handed Joseph an inframonocle on a headband. He pulled it on, and the world became a gritty green. He looked at the creature, and saw what Agata had noticed. There was a narrow opening in the alley wall just behind where it was standing. The stilt-walker paused as it looked around at it, and bobbed its head, the movement awkward, as though it no longer had the bones to bow.
I see, whispered Joseph.
It's standing guard, said Agata.
Yes, said Joseph.
What would they leave behind but think worth guarding? Whispered Agata.
If we want to find out, we are going to have to wait for it to move, or kill it.
He watched as the creature's head turned to and fro.
Assuming that it's alone, he added.
They had seen no other red pilgrims as they tracked the creature, but that did not mean they were not there. Gold shifted behind them. Joseph looked around, about to snap at the proctor to get back into cover.
Stand by, once I have its attention,
said Gold, collapsing the stock on his shotgun and cinching it tight across his chest.
Once it moves, I don't know how long I can give you, so make it count.
He looked up, his face pale in the green twilight of Joseph's dark sight.
With your permission, sir, he added.
Joseph glanced back at the creature. Its head was still moving, back and forth, back and forth.
Go,
he said, without looking round. He heard the low scrunch of Gold's boots on the snow, and then nothing.
As soon as it moves, we move, he said to Agata and the remaining arbitrator.
They did not reply. The snow began to fall more heavily. A sound of glass breaking cut the soft quiet. The stilt-walker's head snapped up and froze. Then the sound came again, louder and more insistent. The creature's body pivoted in the direction of the disturbance. Its head thrust forwards, and Joseph thought that he saw a gleam of teeth inside the cowl. Then it hunched down, whatever limbs hidden beneath its wrappings, folding and bunching. It sprang forwards, bounding in skittering leaps across the snow-covered ground. Joseph thought he heard a panting hiss as it passed the shadows where they crouched, and then it was out of sight. He realized he was holding his breath.
Move,
he said, forcing himself forwards across the open ground between them and the narrow opening the creature had been guarding. Agata was up and moving with him, the last arbitrator covering behind them. He reached the opening first, breath soaring in and out of his lungs. He stopped next to the wall beside it. Agata dropped into place behind him.
"On your word," she said.
"God Emperor, give me this strength," he thought.
"Go,"
he said, and went around the corner into the waiting dark beyond. Chapter 12. The officer paused at the end of the rust-lined corridor. He cocked his head as though he had heard something. His pupils were pinpricks in his irises, even though the light was low. Ninkara watched him through the eyes of the hawk perched in the pipes above him. Its wings furled. The bird was utterly still. She had watched the hatches between the bilge decks and the upper decks for 2 hours before she had found what she was looking for. The lower decks were where the order and hierarchy of command gave way to the wild disorder of deck gangs and the feral voidborn that haunted the dangerous and shunned reaches of a ship. The borderland between the two was sometimes hard to find, but there were always people from the higher levels of any society who wanted or needed something that only the lower places could provide. So she had waited, and after less time than she had expected, fortune had smiled on her. The man had staggered out of a rust-flecked hatch and clanged it behind him. Ninkara could read the stim and karma use at a glance. That was useful, but it was his uniform that made her smile into the dark of her hiding place. He had removed his rank sash and helmet, but he had not wanted to go deep below decks without his sidearm, and that had marked him as clearly as if he had pinned his household commission papers to his forehead. That, and he still had his jacket crumpled under his arm. An ensign, she reckoned, maybe 24 solar. He was perfect for what she needed.
"No one," he mumbled to himself, speech slurring. "No one. Got to keep it together. Got to..."
He leant against the wall for a second, and then flinched his hand back, stared at it, and tried to brush the rust off with his other hand.
"Watch in 5 hours."
He swayed again, looking at his hands, blinking. Ninkara held the threads of her connection to the cyberhawk's taut.
Patience, patience. It was the key to speed, but it had taken her a very long time to learn that lesson.
It had taken the black ships and then the Seminaria Tenebrae for her to be able to see how speed and power and strength all came from one thing. The officer lowered his hands, swayed, and then turned back to step through the opening out of the corridor. The hawk came out of the dark with a single silent beat of wings. The man started a scream, mouth wide. The hawk's claws sank into his neck as its beak darted forward and fastened on his tongue. Ninkara sent a thought, and the injectors implanted in the bird's claws punched into his flesh. Sedatives dumped into his bloodstream. He twitched for a second and then dropped to the deck. The hawk let go of his tongue and withdrew its claw injectors. Sitting on the unconscious man's chest, it flicked its wings and looked up. From the shadows, Ninkara watched it through its twin's eyes.
"It was a punishment," said Cleander. "Or supposed to be, at least."
He looked up at Iaso. He could see his face smeared across her eye lenses. Her face was utterly still.
"Could you, I don't know, nod occasionally, or just make some expression?" "I am a medicae, not a gurning sycophant," she said. "You are talking. I am listening."
"I can't think why I haven't sought out conversations like this before," he muttered.
"What was the alien race that implanted the technology in you?"
He shook his head, looking at his hands resting on top of the green plastic sheet Iaso had draped over him. The seal crest of his house winked back at him. Lions and serpents worked in ruby and jet.
"Not yet," he said quietly. "Let me get there."
Iaso nodded.
"As you wish."
"It began with a species called the Seken."
He gave a grunt of laughter.
"At least that's what I called them, because that was the sound they made, like birds clicking to each other."
"Seken,
Second.
It was during the glory times, the high times of fortune. I was at my best and at my worst. I'd taken the smallest ship of our fleet out, way out beyond the southern trail. And that's where I found the second. They looked like a hound had mated with a fish. They spent most of the time in multicolored cocoon suits. They had ships, very slow ships, no warp capability, but they were slow-blooded and long-lived. They didn't mind spending ages moving between the bits of their domain. They were more curious than anything else. If they'd ever seen a human, it had been a long time ago. There was just about enough to understand between us that we could do a deal. So that's what we did. They liked some scrap from other worlds that I had no use for. I wanted... Well, they had these stones, you see, carved with lines as fine as hair, green and red and blue, jewel bright. And when you touched them, they lit up. The lines glittered. They were just beautiful. But when you held them, when you wrapped your fingers around them and closed your eyes... His fist closed on air, and his eyes shut for a moment. You could see wonderful things. And for a while, the universe was perfect. No needles, no pills, no chemicals washing into your blood. Clean and pure and beautiful.
So you did a trade, said Iaso.
Cleander opened his eyes, blinked, felt the memory drain, and nodded tiredly. Yes, but that was not enough for me. I wanted the source. I wanted everything they had. So I took one of their ships, and we did what we needed to find out where the stones came from. He smiled. Then we went there. The second were not expecting us, and did not like us being there.
There was fighting.
Oh, yes, he said. There was fighting, all right. Quite competent at defending themselves, it turned out. But they did not have the numbers, and they didn't know we were coming, so we got a good haul, a very good haul, and the trip back to the bounds of civilization was a quiet time.
Are you trying to impress me?
He shrugged, winced. In my condition, I'm guessing a drink is out of the question.
100% correct.
Thought so. He shifted, closed his eyes for a moment, and wondered what would happen if he did just try to stand up and leave. ISO was not the kind to bluff. He had not tried to move his legs, but below the neck he could only move his fingers. Part of him wanted to try, but another part did not want to seem a fool.
The alien stones, said ISO. You sold them?
For a tidy sum, and then some. Viola did not like it. She had to move credit through some less than reputable people. But by all the saints and their bones, those stones sold. He paused and shook his head. So I went back for more. The second were not going to be happy, given our earlier encounter, of course, but I took a bigger household force, brought in a couple of more serious Merse companies, and off we went. Well, it turned out that they were far angrier and a lot less stupid than I thought. We came out of the warp near our target, and there were these ships, like splintered black arrowheads. They hit us so fast that we didn't even get a shot before half our engines were slag. When we did shoot back, half of the Auspex returns turned out to be ghosts, shadows in the eyes of our guns. They boarded us. There's a species called the Eldari, old creatures of the stars, quick and prideful and deadly. I'd met Eldari, done some trade with a few even. These creatures were like them, but not like them, you understand. More like their shadows. Just as deadly, but infinitely more cruel. We fought them as they took the ship. Well, I say we fought. We resisted and were massacred. They were just so fast. And once the crew saw them kill some of their friends, I don't know what happened to them all. I never saw that ship or any of the crew alive again.
But you survived?
Not really. They kept me alive. The second had made a bargain with them, you see. Terra alone knows how they knew to find such creatures. But they had, and what they wanted was for me to suffer. They gave me to one of their flesh witches. It cut me open, flayed the flesh from my spine, from buttocks to skull. It had the skill to make sure I was conscious throughout, and once it had me open, it showed me what it was going to do. They were threads when it showed them to me, dozens of silver threads, like a hank of white hair. It planted them inside and put me back together like nothing had ever happened. Then they sent me on my way.
If they are as you described and did what you say, what possible reason could they have to just let you go?
Because I made a deal with them, said Cleander. For a moment he held Iaso's last gaze and then dropped his eyes. He nodded to himself. Of course I made a deal with them. The second had paid them in living slaves of their own kind. They had paid for my ship to be taken and for me to suffer torment before being handed back to them. But then the creatures that took me found one of the stones. It was in my pocket, just dropped in my coat pocket. How stupid is that? The first time they brought me around, there was one of them standing in front of me. It looked like a leader. The skin of its face was like sun-bleached paper.
Most sinister, said Iaso. They wanted the stones, then.
Oh, yes, they really, really did. I think they could have forced me to tell them, but once I opened my mouth with a counteroffer, they were happy to hear it.
What did you offer them?
Everything about the second, about the stones and the planet they came from, and an idea. That they use handing me back to the second as an opportunity to ambush them in turn, to take them or kill them and then take back the stones.
They agreed?
They did. Afterwards, a long time afterwards, when I had time to think about it, I thought that they went with it because it amused them. My desperation and treachery amused them. Anyway, it happened, and I played my part and told them what I knew. They kept their word, which, all things considered, is surprising, don't you think? He tried a smile. Iaso did not return it.
And they cut you open?
As a gift, he said, the words falling cold on his tongue. That was what they called it, a gift.
A gift of what?
Life. They said it would keep me alive so that I could appreciate its other qualities one day, when I had forgotten that such a day was to come. He bowed his head and closed his eyes. Iaso did not say anything. As much as I have enjoyed this conversation, he said after a moment, and if it is all the same with you, I think I will sleep now. Iaso did not reply, but he heard her walk away, her chrome servitors buzzing in her wake. Ninkara watched the officer wake and blink at the dark. The dull throb of his thoughts filled her awareness. She was not much of a telepath. Her skills were specific and low on the index that the Imperium used to rate the raw strength of such things. But her skill was enough to sense the rough shape and taste of surface thoughts and emotions if she concentrated. She could not dip into minds and take what she needed, but there were other ways. She had brought him back down to the quiet of the lower decks. It had taken an hour of dragging and carrying him through rarely used passages, but she needed quiet for this. She waited as the officer stirred. He was lashed to an upright pipe, arms above his head. A single dim glow-globe shone above him. Beyond that circle of light, he would be able to see nothing. She watched as his eyes cleared and focused. The hawk swept out of the dark, wings spread, claws and beak wide. The man screamed.
The bird landed on his chest, wings beating, claws digging into his flesh, shrieking its cry into his face. The sounds rose and echoed in the still dark.
"Be still," said Ninkara,
sending the same thought command. The hawk on the man's chest froze, and then furled its wings. It cocked its head, staring up into the man's terrified face. Ninkara stepped forward, the other hawk on her shoulder. The man's eyes flicked to her and then back to the bird perched in front of his face. She could feel his panic settling into terror now.
"I will ask questions. You will answer," she said.
"Who are you?"
His voice was thick with the wound the hawk had bit into his tongue. She twitched the thought, and the hawk on his chest opened its beak.
"You will answer. That is all you will do."
He nodded once, his eyes fixed on the hawk.
"The Inquisitor called Covenant. You know of him?"
The man nodded.
"And a woman in his circle, or a prisoner called Enna Girid. You know of her?"
"No," he said. "I mean, I don't know those that he keeps around him. I'm a crew officer. I'm not part of the household. Mistress von Castellan keeps only household crew close to the Inquisitor."
Ninkara felt the truth in his mind. He was very afraid, and not very bright. She was not surprised by his answer. In fact, it was just as she had expected. This man was not the path to finding her target, just a stepping stone. The hawks twitched as her thoughts bled into theirs. The man must have seen the movement, because he started talking without being asked.
"The Mistress of Threads controls it all. It's all shut and guarded on the upper levels. You have to be household, or you can't get anywhere, and even that lot don't know much. Anything around the Inquisitor's business. The von Castellans are the only ones to know anything."
Ninkara nodded. She had already decided that the only way to find Girid was by getting to one of the von Castellan's close associates. That, or luck, and counting on luck was just damn fool faith by another name.
"Tell me everything you know about them, where they eat, where they sleep, who is close to them most of the time."
"No," he said. The hawk twitched its head. "No, I mean, I don't know anything. I only took a commission contract a year ago. I've never even met them. I'm on the sump deck watch. I've only been into the higher decks once. I don't know what you want."
He trailed off, and she felt the fear form in his mind that he had said just the wrong thing. And he was right. Ninkara reached casually for the shard blade fastened to the small of her back. The hawk on the ensign's chest spread its wings to take flight.
"Wait!"
The man flinched, eyes wide. The terror wrapping his thoughts was white hot now.
"I know something. Please."
Ninkara stilled.
"Talk," she said.
"After the last transition, something happened on the bridge. The Duke and the Void Mistress were injured."
He paused, panting as he fought and lost with his panic.
"How?"
"I don't know. It was just what I heard. Watch change talk. They said that the Duke had been taken to the primary Medicaid wing."
"And?"
"And he's still there. Whatever happened, the word is that he's still there. The Mistress of Threads is running things, but the Duke, he's still in the primary Medicaid wing."
He fell silent, panting, eyes on Ninkara.
"You have been to this Medicaid wing? You know where it is?"
"Yes. A household officer had an arm crushed during a gunnery drill. I was one of the ones that got her to the chirurgeons."
He was telling the truth, no doubt. More than that, his hope that he had bought his life was bubbling images to the surface of his thoughts. Blurred images of hoists, passages, and doors flowed through Ninkara's mind.
"Tell me how to get there, clearly and slowly."
"And you will let me live?"
"I swear and oath it, in the name of the God Emperor of mankind, and by all I hold holy."
She flicked out a thread of will, and the hawk released from his chest and rose to perch on a girder above them. She watched his eyes flick across her face, saw his thoughts as he tried to decide to believe her. He really, really wanted there to be a way out of this.
All right. All right, he said, licking his lips.
He talked. Ninkara listened and watched the images of what he described shimmer across his thoughts. She was not strong enough to pull clearer mental images from him, but it would be enough. She memorized it all, folding it up into a mental space where it would stay, clean and accessible in entirety. Another gift of the Tyranites, given a long time ago, in a place so far away that it might as well have been a dream. When he was done, he hung from his bonds, panting with adrenaline, eyes shining as he waited. Ninkara drew the shard sword. It unfolded with a rustle like dry leaves stirring in a breath of wind.
What?
He stammered.
You said you would let me live. You swore.
By the God Emperor and all that I hold holy. But if he is a god, then he doesn't care if you die. And I hold nothing holy.
He only managed to draw breath to scream before the fractal edge opened his throat. Severita watched as the metal of the casket began to glow. She could feel heat on her face. The cryo machines had begun emitting a high whine and were venting thick plumes of steam.
You are not permitted to kill her, said Severita out loud.
She had ceased kneeling hours before and now stood a pace to the left of Mylasa and two from the casket containing Enagirid. Severita's bare sword rested on her left shoulder. She had not moved or spoken since she had risen, just watched as the worms of witchlight formed on the casket's metal.
I am not killing her, said Mylasa's voice in her head. If it ever comes to it, I will leave that to you.
A thick rime of frost covered Mylasa, caking her robes and clotting her eye sockets. Sparks glittered around her head. Severita felt a pain build behind her eyes as she turned her head to look at the psyker.
Of course, your best way of helping me not to do something accidentally fatal would be to not make stupid comments that require me to split my attention to reply to you. I have a duty to protect her. Ah, yes, duty. Simple, mindless duty, the balm and salve of the guilty and the self-loathing. Don't you serve from duty? Habit, I think. Yes, habit more than anything else. Or maybe because, as an abomination in the eyes of the pure and righteous, I have few better options in this galaxy. Or maybe I just enjoy my work. After all, we can't all be as miserable as you, now can we?
Severita turned to stare back at the casket.
You hate us, don't you? Perceptive, but imprecise. To be fair, I hate you and your kind. Everyone else has at least an even chance.
Severita thought about not responding to the barb.
Why? She asked after a second. Because your kind of faith is the kind that does not question, that would run me through with that sword and not think twice, and all you would need was an order from someone you thought could forgive you whatever sin you'd think you'd committed. I am a sinner. You are a narrow-minded creature filled with self-loathing. At least we have that in common.
Mylasa's thought voice was silent. Severita nodded at the casket.
I am sure you have also considered that besides being here to kill her, if needed, I am also here to protect you, if it comes to that. I need no protection. Perhaps, but I'm here anyway, and here I will stay. It is my duty. Oh, well done. How very tidy. Now, as delightful as this has been, I must give my full attention to my duty.
Severita felt her face become taut. Then she shook her head, and silence fell in her thoughts and in the frost and heat-filled room. The chamber beneath the surface of Iago was brighter than when she had last seen it. Figures in rags filled the spaces around the stone sarcophagi, all held in a frozen tableau. All but three of them were masked. She could see open mouths in the ragged holes in their masks, tongues frozen behind teeth as they sang a song that she could not hear. Of the unmasked figures, the first was Idris, her face impassive. The other was the same wild-eyed hermit they had met on the shore of the poisoned lake of Iago's underworld. His teeth were bared, and ropes of lightning crawled over his scalp. His hands gripped a woman by the hair and neck, pushing her down towards the surface of the liquid. She recognized the woman. It was herself. Mouth open to gasp for air, skin blistering with the touch of the toxins in the water. An arc of droplets hung in the air, linking her to the rippled mirror of liquid.
"They remade you," said Mylasa, stepping into view.
Her green silk dress had morphed into an emerald body glove.
"The renewed killed you. They drowned you in poison and brought you back to the living as someone else. They made you one of them, reborn, renewed."
Enna did not reply. She was staring at the scene, at the cold hardness in Idris's eye.
"From there, Idris gave you a new past, a new life to remember and believe in." "This is wrong. I don't remember this. This did not happen."
"It did, Enna," said Mylasa. She reached over the lip of the sarcophagus and dipped her finger into the still, rippled water. The ripples did not move or change.
"And you do remember it. This is your memory. It was buried deep, but it was there." "Idris would not have done this. She was a heretic, Enna. She lied and deceived and manipulated. She took the renewed from Telicto and used them to steal his secrets and then to kill him. She was not a victim of the massacre at the conclave. She was the orchestrator of that atrocity. She did it, not Telicto, not someone else. Her." "But Telicto was there. I saw him. We all saw him," said Enna, even as she could feel the objection fading into nothing.
Mylasa had moved to stand next to the frozen image of Idris. She looked up at the Inquisitor's eyes.
"No, Telicto wasn't there, Enna. He was long dead. What you saw, what everyone saw, was something else. I don't know for certain, but I would guess that it was another member of the Renewed, shaped to pass for him. Very clever, really. The Triumvirate stole his secrets, then used his identity to cover their own activities. We were tracing what we thought were Telicto's experiments in warpcraft for years, but now you have to wonder if they weren't his at all."
Enna opened her mouth to object, but the words stopped before they could reach her lips. A different thought formed in their wake instead, cold and hard in her mind.
"She's alive, isn't she? I saw her die, but she is alive."
Mylasa smiled sorrowfully.
"That seems very likely. What you saw, what everyone saw, was a show of shadows. And she left me. She left me with Covenant."
She paused and looked again at the frozen image of herself before she was plunged into the poison-filled sarcophagus.
"You are looking for revelation." "Why?"
she said. Mylasa let out a long breath. The image of the chamber and the rag-clad figures was fading, shape and color smudging. Only the image of Mylasa remained sharp and clear.
"That, my dear, is a question we are here to answer."
Darkness billowed up around the psyker, and Enna was drowning in lightless water again. Small light that is this soul. Aesir ducked back into the shadows, holding her breath. It was hot down here in the deep root of the monastery, very hot. The stones of the walls were crowded with crumbling saints, and the dust-covered floors were warm under her feet. She had run and crawled down and down until she did not know where she was, until the dark was all there was. Then she had stopped and breathed, and whatever had driven her down here faded. Hunger had filled her belly, and the silence of the dark had suddenly seemed strangling rather than comforting. She had closed her eyes, and the child's prayers of her mother and father spoken over her as she tried to sleep in the decks of pilgrim ships breathed into her mind. O small light that is this soul, shine in the dark undimmed. O great light that is all, shine for this soul so small. She listened, and the memories must have tugged her from exhaustion to sleep, because she was walking down a corridor now, feet padding on red and white tiles, eyes looking up at tapestries showing a man of gold, who must be the emperor, wounded and bleeding, the blood from his wounds falling into the hands of haloed saints who crowded close to him. There were skulls stacked in niches along the walls, and candles burning on iron stands. It was all somehow soft and strangely liquid, like a reflection glimpsed on a pool of oil and water. There was someone there, a woman in white robes hung with chains. There was another person there, too, a man in brushed steel armor with a neat iron-gray beard. Aesir did not feel afraid any more, just puzzled. She did not recognize either of the people, and though the surroundings felt familiar, it was not anywhere she had been. It looked like a part of the monastery, but not one she recognized. Maybe it was one of the higher cloisters, up amongst the spires where only the holy orders most blessed went. But then, why was it here in her dreams?
"Lord Inquisitor," said the woman in chains, bowing low, "we will find the witch."
"That would be something that I would not advise," said the man.
"O small light that is hope, shine for all that will see." The words of prayer whispered in her ear. She spun around, and light poured into her eyes, red but bright, like the glow of a vast coal before it cooled. Aesir tried to move away, but the dream of floors and walls had gone, and the glow was getting closer, and there were voices shouting and whispering and calling, and she could see now that the light was not one fire. It was thousands, millions, a countless mass of flames forming a single inferno. Heat broke over her. She felt herself begin to burn. She wanted to scream. She could not scream. She opened her eyes just as the scream was forming on her lips. It drained back into her throat. She was sitting in a dark corridor, feet curled under her. And there was light, red and orange, flicking in the middle distance. She could hear the sound of footsteps coming closer, like the sound of a river flowing over rocks. A wave of figures in robes of every color were coming down the passage towards her. Some held burning torches, some whips and ropes.
"There she is!"
She tried to run, but found her limbs would not move.
"Witch! Witch!"
"O small light that is this soul, shine in the dark undimmed." But she could not move, and the words of the prayer were fading, and something was rising within her, blotting out thoughts with pain and anger, and she could see nothing but dust, and the ruins of a dead city, and the howl of wolves was the laughter of the wind. Her eyes were still open as the shadows around her flickered and crashed forwards towards the oncoming torchlight. Then the screams filled her ears.
"Oh, small light!"
And then she was falling and falling, and could not hear the words of her lost prayer. Chapter 13. Agata went through the alley mouth just behind Joseph. The gap was only just wide enough for them to pass through. To the souls of the unworthy, the gates of purity are like the eye of a needle, whispered a memory in her head. The space beyond was green in the light of her helm display. Static popped and fizzed at the edge of her sight. She could see Joseph just in front of her, hammer in his hands, moving forward a step at a time. There was an opening between the roofs above. A few scattered snowflakes fell from the slit of night sky.
"There is blood here," said Joseph quietly.
"How can you tell?"
"I can smell it."
Agata signaled the arbitrator to cover the entrance gap. Joseph edged further forwards. Agata looked around at the close-pressed walls. There were shapes attached to them, lumpen and still. Agata paused, stepped closer, and then away.
"There are severed hands pinned to the walls," she said.
Joseph stopped suddenly. Agata looked around, bolter up and swinging with her gaze. Then she saw. A carved head lay against the end wall of the opening. In the thin green light of her dark vision, its features were defined by shadows. Dark fluid streaked the stone of its cheeks. Metal bars had been hammered into its stone eyes, and a pair of human arms hung from them. A body sprawled beneath them, half lying on the ground, half hanging.
"What?" began Agata.
"It's a shrine," said Joseph. "A profaned shrine."
Joseph was bending down, slowly, eyes fixed on the marks daubed on the stone face. They hurt to look at.
"A shrine to what? What can such creatures worship?"
"The truth," said a voice like the rattle of dried skin.
Joseph jerked back to his feet, hammer rising. Agata's gun was aimed at the figure pinned to the stone face. It was moving, shifting under its wrapping of red rags.
"That is what we bring. The truth."
Agata's finger tensed to fire. Joseph raised a hand.
"No,"
he said. A dry rustle of a chuckle came from the figure.
"You see, you want the truth too," said the figure.
"A man," thought Agata, but there was something about the way his words slid into her ears that made her think of serpents gliding over dry sand.
"What is this?" growled Agata. "He is one of them. They did this to one of their..."
"No," said Joseph. "They were guarding this, guarding him. He is not just one of them."
Agata watched as Joseph tilted his head.
"Are you?"
"I was called Craid, and I am the Pilgrim of Hate."
There was a smile in the words. Agata looked back to where the arbitrator stood watch at the opening onto the alley. Joseph squatted down so that he was at eye level with the man.
"What are you doing?"
asked Agata.
"Getting answers," said Joseph, and Agata could hear the control in it.
He looked back to Craid.
"You started this, didn't you?"
"I was the false prophet, yes," said Craid. "But a prophet only. I have done my work, and my children have set me down to sleep on a bed of pain."
"What are you doing here? Who sent you here?"
"Providence sent me," said Craid, and shuddered, his whole body jerking.
Fresh blood glittered on the metal spikes pinning him to the saint's head.
"It is our time, and I am the prophet of that future."
"And what do you see in that future?"
"Joseph," began Agata.
He held up a hand to her.
"What does it mean, you mean?"
asked Craid, his smile broad and bloody.
"Why am I here? Why did this happen? What is my significance?"
A low, dry, racking cough.
"My significance is that this false paradise of ours must burn, and so someone must set the first fire. It was seen, you see, on necks. I killed my Redeemer, just as my children have nailed me to this shrine to die. In his pain, he saw that the one who will bring final truth and tip the world into fire was made here, right here, a child of the dark. This is unholy ground, and all that was needed for the prophesied destroyer to rise was for this place, its cradle, to burn and drown in blood. So I came and made it so."
Joseph was silent, his face hard. Agata could feel her own anger at the blasphemy.
"You are a priest, aren't you?" said Craid. "I can smell the blindness on you. How does your god comfort you now, priest?
Does he whisper promises in your ears? Does he fill your heart with a light of certainty and meaning? The man grinned, the skin of his face creased like paper.
Or is he silent? I know. I was once like you, just like you. Once, worlds and stars away, I had faith. I believed. I knew that there was a plan, a great and divine plan that everything fitted into. I knew that he protects. I knew that he was light and all else darkness.
Craig shuddered, and then coughed a great gobbet of bloody phlegm onto his chin.
Then I was shown the truth. You can see it, you know. You can see it in a boy dying on a plague bed, or in the drip of blood from the lips of someone that has just spent their last breath asking for grace, for compassion. You can see it then, bright and clear as a candle lit for prayer. And you know what it is.
He breathed in, and the air rattled wetly in his throat.
Nothing. There is no hope, no light, no divine will guiding and protecting us. There is just the embrace of night, and the long, slow, screaming slide down to the grave.
Agatha felt coldness run through her. The words the man was speaking slid and shivered in her skull. Every instinct trained into her was screaming for her to pull the trigger and punch a shell through this thing's body. Then she noticed that his eyes had moved from Joseph to her, as though he could see her clearly through the dark.
You, old daughter of a corpse, you want to know more. Do you want to know the truth?
Heretic, she said,
the word somehow cold and flat in her mouth.
I can show you, he said. I was shown it. I was shown that there are other powers in this universe, great and vast powers, that hunger and claw at us and the excrement we call life. Some call them gods, but they too are false. Life's last mark of cruelty on our skin. All gods are lies, and all hope is dead. What did you come here to do? Asked Joseph. And once you see that, you see that the only reaction is hate. What else can there be? Hate is purity. Oblivion is salvation. And once I knew that, I had purpose again. It filled me. It is the truth. I spoke with my lips, and by my hand others saw. You will answer me. It began here. On this spot it was born, the false light, the beast of truth, the pilgrim of hate, red without and night within. The tools of false gods are my claws, and hate my gift. I was not the beginning, and I am not the end. The truth lives, you fools. It began here with false saint tears, and it lives and walks, and you cannot stop it. It wants to be free. It is coming. The last true pilgrim of hate, the false prophet of oblivion. And I have laid the wood for its birthing pyre. The fire of this last candle shall become an inferno. When all burns and there is only fire and night, it will come, and it will bring truth to all.
Craig smiled. Agatha heard three loud gunshots in the middle distance.
Joseph,
she said. The preacher had not moved, but was still looking at the smiling, bloody mask of Craig's face.
The world ends by many hands, priest. The deluded, the blind, and the cruel. You are as dead as your God, hissed Craig. I can see it inside you. I can taste it. Can you feel the cold hand on your shoulder?
Craig leaned forward suddenly, so that his lips were inches from Joseph's ear.
Listen. Listen to me. I have a gift for you.
The arbitrator at the end of the alley jerked his gun up.
Joseph!
Your god is dead, and soon you will join him.
The arbitrator's shotgun roared. Agata pivoted towards the opening to the alley. Craig was laughing, cold and shrill, blood bubbling up with the sound. Joseph brought the hammer up and then down with a snarl. Craig's skull shattered into bloody pulp and scraps of bone. The arbitrator fired again. A shape loomed across the snow and night, towering, stilt-limbed, ragged wrappings billowing around it. Agata had an instant to catch an impression of skin stretched over bone, and then an iron-tipped arm punched down and lifted the arbitrator off the ground in a spray of blood. The cloister of the Sage Order of the Faithful echoed with voices. Ladders rattled along metal rails, built into the high shelves running down every corridor. Brothers and sisters of the order hurried between rooms with armfuls of scrolls and carts of books. In every contemplation cell, men and women bent over texts, running bone reading wands over faded words. In the great scriptorium at the center of the cloister, the scribes had stopped work on new manuscripts for the first time in living memory. Scribe, archivist, or novice, all were plunging back through the stacks of monastery records. Iacto moved through it all, waving away signs and words of respect. He found Claudia in the great stack, standing on a wooden walkway above the cylindrical shaft lined with the order's oldest tomes. Here, and throughout the rest of the order's cloister, were the records of days for the entire monastery complex, written as an act of devotion by members of the order. There were other records and libraries, of course. Several of the other orders kept and produced all manner of scriptures, but it was the anointed duty of the Sage Order of the Faithful to mark the passing of days and to keep the knowledge of the monastery alive.
"Brother Abbot," said Claudia
as he approached. She was working in a ledger, marking something off. Books lay open on brass stands around her. Her face was pinched, and there were black shadows of fatigue under her eyes.
"My message reached you quickly, then?"
"Message?" he asked. She looked up at him, a frown deepening. He shook his head.
"No message reached me."
"Then why?"
"The Inquisitor is not here because of the uprising. He is here for something else. He is not here to help save the monastery. Whatever he is looking for, we must find first. It is the only thing that is keeping him here. Without it, we are alone."
Claudia was very still for a moment, then picked up the ledger she was working in and turned it around so that he could see it.
"My message was that we have found something."
Iacto's eyes flickered over the pages. Dates in the monastery's calendar form ran down one of the pages with ciphered notes on the facing page.
"What are these?" "The Inquisition has been here before," she said, "many times before. These are just dates and codes for the keeping of the books of days. These are dates from the past 100 years when there is no record, none, not a note of her death or the giving of a pilgrim gift."
"Curious, but..."
"Except there are records, or there were. Members of the order were performing their devotion in these times. Their presence is recorded, as are the number of lines scribed. But there is no trace of what they wrote."
Iacto nodded, reading the details from the ledger.
"The Inquisition, though. How can you be sure?" "Marginalia. I looked at the prayer books of the scribes that are noted as devoting themselves to work on the days when there are no records."
"And?"
"There was nothing in most of them, but in one..."
She held up a small book, bound in plain, worn leather. It was a prayer pillow. Each member of the order made and kept such a book, reading from it and inscribing prayers into it.
"This belonged to a brother Talo of our order."
Iacto took the book and opened it. Pages had been marked with black ribbons. He looked at the neat text running down the page. At the bottom, blurred where the writer had clearly tried to scrape the ink away, was a line of cursive running up the sides of the verses of cant for that day. And the anointed of the left hand of the most holy emperor did come with the morning light, and I was summoned to attend him, and to give him record of all the strangeness that had passed within the monastery. Iacto stopped reading and looked up at Claudia.
How could this not be known? If the Inquisition came here before, they must have seen someone, and someone must have seen them.
Claudia reached out and turned the pages of the prayer book to another black ribbon, then another, and another.
It goes on, telling of how an inquisitor came in secret to the monastery, and how Talo was summoned each time to talk about events in the records, miracles, the unexplained, rumours of saints and witches. It seems that he became a tutor, or teacher, or keeper of some sort.
A tutor? That is the implication. What would the Inquisition need a scribe to tutor?
Claudia did not answer, but took the book back and began to turn the pages, showing him brief entries, all partially scraped away.
He begins willingly, even exultant. He talks about revelation. He says how he is blessed to have been singled out for this task. He writes the word revelation against pages and prayers for months, and the prayers are about forgiveness and moulding the soul. I'm not certain, but I think that they were keeping...
Someone, said Iacto, looking up, eyes fixed on the cliff of shelves and the bustle of his brothers and sisters.
The Inquisition was keeping someone here in this monastery, someone who needed tutoring.
Claudia nodded.
Someone that frightened Brother Talo. You see, he writes like this for some time, but then the prayers he copies into the pages become about fear, entreaties to the emperor for purification, forgiveness, or protection.
The obvious questions are who and where, and then the even more obvious, why?
There are no answers, but there is this, she said,
and turned to a page and pointed at a single passage. Iacto looked at the page. He looked up at Claudia, feeling the shock spread across his face. She met his look and nodded.
Yes, he said, seeing the obvious logic spreading through his thoughts. It had to be. How else could the records be purged and this all happen and it not be spoken of?
He closed the book, tucked it into his robe, and began to walk away, back up and out of the archive.
"Where are you going?"
asked Claudia to his back. He did not answer. He paused and looked around at the robed figures moving on the platforms, and the books piled on shelves and lecterns. His duty, the holy work and treasure of every man and woman who had stood in this place.
"Get all of our order out of the cloister," he called to Claudia. "Get as many of them as far away from the lower reaches as you can. Close to the landing pads, if you can get that far. It won't be long before night comes for us here, too.
Iacto was still for a moment.
What are you going to do? Asked Claudia.
Iacto looked at the note at the bottom of the prayer book, then gave a cold smile.
I am going to go and see what salvation your discovery can buy us.
The cold smile had not moved from his face, and in his mind the single line written by the dead monk turned over and over in his thoughts.
Most blessed are we who stand under the sight of those who keep vigil in the most holy emperor's name. She is an abomination. The girl is an abomination.
It had been the last marked page in the book, and after it were only blank pages, waiting for prayers and thoughts that would not come.
Joseph turned in time to see the arbitrator who had been guarding the alley mouth yanked into the air on the stilt walker's hand. The man fired, shot blasted through rags and flesh. The stilt walker arched its back and shrieked, with a voice that sounded all too human. It brought up its other hand and tore the arbitrator's head from his torso. Agata fired then. Three bolts punched into its shoulders and head. It shuddered back, dropping the remains of the arbitrator. Its bulk still blocked the exit from the alley. Joseph ran towards it, forcing down the numbness of his injuries. The stilt walker lashed a kick at Agata. Joseph saw the flash of sharp metal. Agata moved back fast, bolter braced to fire, and her leg, the wounded leg that had carried her since the first ambush, crumpled beneath her. Joseph saw it happen in a jammed clock slowness as he ran towards the opening. Agata's gun fired. The bolt cut wide. She was trying to rise, fresh blood running down the battered silver of her greave, black in the cold monochrome of his dimming vision. And the stilt walker was coiled back, limbs bunching under its rags, blood showering from it. Agata's gun was rising, but too slow. It sprang forwards, and Joseph swung his hammer up, even as he knew that he would not reach it in time. A shotgun blast roared out of the dark. A solid round struck the stilt walker dead in the center of its mass and pitched it forwards. It caught itself as it fell, twisting around with a snap of popping vertebrae. Joseph reached it and swung his hammer down. An arm, stick-thin and iron-hard, flicked out and hit him in the gut as his blow descended. He flew back and hit the alley wall. Stars exploded in his sight. He was gasping, his insides burning. The thing was rising, its rags bloody tatters. Another shotgun blast, and the thing slammed backwards with the impact. Proctor Gald walked out of the dark, his gun levelled. His helmet was gone, and the left side of his face was a bloody ruin. He racked the slide of his shotgun. The spent casing clicked to the ground. The stilt walker leapt from the ground. Gald pulled the trigger. Shot ripped through the creature like hail through wet paper. Agata fired. A trio of bolt shells tore the creature's left arm and leg off in a ripple of explosions. Joseph forced himself forwards. The creature, though, was still alive. It struck Gold hard and rammed him back onto the snowy ground. It was gurgling, bloody froth gagging its shrieks as it scrabbled at the proctor with its iron claws. Gold had his hands up. Joseph was next to the creature, hammer swinging up above his head. The creature battered Gold's hands away. Joseph swung his hammer down. There was no prayer on his lips, no plea to the Emperor for strength, just the raw surge of muscle and anger. The head of the hammer struck the thing's back. Force juddered the haft in his hands. He heard bones crack, but he was already shifting his weight to pull the hammer up and around to hit it again and again.
Joseph!
He heard the words and then felt a hand yank at his shoulder.
Joseph!
He lowered the hammer. Agata was next to him. He was gasping air, his eyes still blurred and swimming with spots of bright color. He shook his head, trying to clear it, and looked at the tangled heap of flesh and rags on the ground at his feet. He could see limbs and skin where the fabric had fallen aside. Crude stitches crisscrossed starved flesh that looked as if it had been stretched, melted, and set like a child's sugar treat. Some of it looked human, other parts of it like a dog. A jagged rune spiraled across an exposed area of skin. When he shifted his gaze, the mark remained for a second inside his eyes. The claws on its hands and legs were metal blades jammed into flesh and bone and bound in place with barbed wire. Joseph recognized a paring knife and the blade of a set of shears amongst the blades, both sharpened so that point and edge shone in his dark sight. A gurgling cough pulled the hammer up in his hands for a second before he lowered it again. Gald lay half under the thing's remains. The proctor's face was a mask of his own blood now. His left arm ended in a torn stump of ripped fingers and twisted armor. More blood was flowing in a steady beat from a hole punched through his chest plate.
"Help me!"
he called to Agata, and bent to pull the proctor out from under the dead stiltwalker. Gald shook his head.
"There are more of them."
Blood foamed from his mouth.
"They will be coming. Taking that one down made a lot of noise." "We will get you back to the monastery," said Joseph. "There are medics. You will live."
Gold smiled. His chest was heaving now, each breath jolting through him.
"Old and fat, and a soft fool, too," hissed Gold.
Then he twitched and went still. Joseph did not move for a second. The blood that had been beating from the hole in Gull's chest had become an oozing trickle.
"He was right," said Agata. "We have to move, and move now."
Joseph nodded. His hands were red.
"We have to reach Covenant," he said.
Craig's words rattled in the hollow of his thoughts.
"It is coming, the last true pilgrim of hate."
He forced himself to stand and felt himself sway. Close by, a hooting cry rose up into the snow-flecked air. He took a first step and paused, looking back at Gold lying on the cold ground, snowflakes already turning his blood to pink slush. Then he bent and closed the eyelids over the man's pale eyes.
"Emperor of all, welcome the soul of this, thy unfailing servant," he said,
and then straightened and began to limp towards the lights of the distant monastery. Crowds ringed the entrance to the great cathedral. Members of every order, high and low, pressed close, shouting for the shrine guards to let them into the sanctuary. Half of them thought that the great cathedral was the safest place to be. Others saw it as a holy place that the emperor would never let harm come to. All the mob wanted to get inside for one purpose, to live a little longer. But the shrine guard had their orders. They barred the path to the high doors, their bronze shields touching, iron staves raised and ready. Iacto shoved his way to the front, ignoring the words shouted at him. He stepped towards the line of guards.
"I am Abbot Iacto," he called.
A loud shout went up from behind him, and then a broken tile flew through the air and broke on one of the guard's shields. They took a step forwards. He had never been in a fight, let alone a war zone, but he could read the tension in the guards even through their masks. He stepped out of the crowd towards the shield wall, hands raised in peace, and spoke as loudly and as calmly as he could.
"I am Abbot Iacto of the Sage Order of the Faithful. I must be admitted. I must see the bishop."
"Get back!"
shouted one of the guards, and shoved out with his shield. Iacto staggered back into the press of bodies behind. A jeering growl rose around him as some hands pushed him forward and some tried to pull him back. He recognized a woman in the robes of a senior sister in the Order of the Blessed Flame. Her face was twisted around a shout, her eyes flashing with rising panic.
"This is what we truly are," he thought. "Underneath all the piety and prayer, we now stand pure and clear. For all the words and forms we stood behind, we now feel the world shake. And what do we find we are? Saints or weak souls wanting to live just a little longer?"
He stepped back towards the shields. The guard raised his iron truncheon.
"I have come from the Inquisitor," he said, clearly, but in a voice that he hoped would not carry.
The guard hesitated, and Iacto stepped closer.
"I have been in the House of Concordance, consulting with the Inquisitor's servants, and I must see the bishop immediately."
The guard glanced behind himself, as though for help. Word of the Inquisitor's arrival had spread almost as fast as the panic. Iacto was not certain which was the source of more terror to most, the murder tide rising from the drifts, or the coming of the Inquisition. The guard looked back at Iacto, who had stayed perfectly still.
"Immediately,"
he repeated. The guard hesitated for another second, and then stepped to the side, motioning for Iacto to get through the shield wall fast. The crowd behind him roared as they saw the opening and surged forward. Iacto was through the line and passing through a small sally door next to the closed main doors. Silence closed over him as he stepped beyond. The vast space beneath the processional was dark. The candles that hung in their thousands on wheel-like candelabras were unlit. The air smelled of dust. In the distance, the flames of the high altar burned, the light slicing into thin shadows as it passed through avenues and rings of pillars as wide as castles. Iacto paused for a moment, considering his next step. Bishop Zelita had a private chapel and sanctuary beneath the high altar. In times like these, she was likely to be there. He took a step towards the light of the altar and then paused. There were sure to be more shrine guards around the high altar and the entrance to the bishop's sanctuary. He did not want to have the same argument with them as he had had with the guards on the main doors, an argument he was not convinced he would win again, and he was not certain how much time there was. The Inquisitor was not here to protect or save them, and that meant that a new set of decisions had to be made if they were not all going to end as ashes. Zalita was the only one who might be able to do something, but she could only do that if she knew, and soon. There was no time to argue with terrified underlings. There were other ways into the sanctuary. Like anywhere in a monastery complex, for every door and passage you could see, there were more that you couldn't. After another moment of thought, he slid sideways into the shadowed corners. He found the small door he needed tucked in behind a dried fountain made to wash pilgrims' feet. He almost forgot to take a light, and then took an unlit candle from a stand and lit it with a striker. Then down he went, into the narrow, dust-scented world of the Undercroft. He edged through passages, shoulders brushing the bare stone walls, pausing when he found another door, or spur, to remember the plans of the passages he had examined in the past. He took a wrong turn 3 times, but at last reached a doorway only 0.5 meter wide, the wood black with age. It was locked, but like most whisper doors in the monastery, the lock opened to the flat iron key he carried as a mark of his office. As he pushed it open a crack, the thought of whether any of the red pilgrims knew their way through the whisper tunnels crossed his mind. A chill glided over his skin, but he shook it free. It was a worry that would have to wait. He pushed the door wider. The hinges turned silently, as though they had been oiled. A corridor ran to the left and right. The light was low. Only single candles had been lit on the candelabras hanging from the ceiling. Red and white tiles covered the floor, and tapestries showing the wounded emperor scattering blood to his most holy saints hung over the stone walls. There were doors leading off the corridor in both directions. Most were narrow and would lead to contemplation cells. On occasion, in the past, a bishop would choose a few select pilgrims to become companions of their solitude. They would live down here in the bishop's sanctuary, never seeing another soul outside of the bishop's entourage. Dark whispers said the companions' prayers were said to have kept some bishops young past the age of dotage. Orphaned children and the dying had once been much favoured. Iacto had never heard of Zalita following the practice, but he had also never been into the bishop's sanctuary before. He stood for a moment, orientating himself to what he could remember of the plans, and then turned in the direction of the chapel. He moved carefully, listening and glancing around as he took every step, but all was silent. That was strange. He had expected at least a token number of the shrine guard, but there were none. He reached the chapel door. It was shut. He paused, then pushed it softly. It was not locked, and hinged open a crack without making a sound. He pushed it slightly wider and slipped through. He was not sure why he was moving like a thief, other than he had no formal permission to be there. But something about the silent, half-lit passages made him shrink from shouting his presence. The chapel was small, barely 20 paces from door to altar. The only light came from 6 votive candles burning on the altar, beneath a statue of the emperor carved from jet. Gilded chains circled and weighed down his bare shoulders, tethering him to a sea of golden hands reaching up to him. There were no benches or pews. Those who came here to pray knelt on the stone floor. At that moment, there was only one supplicant. Bishop Zalita knelt at the foot of the altar, her back straight and her head bowed. The weighted chains of her order lay on the floor around her, their weight lifted for this time of prayer. Iacto shut the door silently behind himself, and was about to step forwards when Bishop Zalita spoke.
"I knew one of you would come," she said, without moving. "I had faith."
Iacto shook off his surprise and opened his mouth to speak.
"Faith," said another voice.
Iacto froze. Ice poured through him.
"Perhaps."
A man stepped out of the gloom beside the altar and into the glow of the candlelight. Behind him, the shadow of a narrow whisper door stood open. The man was robed in aged patchwork cloth. His head was clean-shaven, his skin golden dark, and faded tattoo dots marked his cheeks. Iacto would have taken him for one of the countless ascetics that came to holy places with just the faith in their hearts and the air in their lungs. But there was something in his eyes and the way he moved that made Iacto shrink back to the shadows by the door. The man stepped next to Zelita. The bishop did not move from her place of prayer.
"You doubt me," she said. "I kept your revelation safe here, and in all these years since I have kept its secrets, but in all those years I have heard nothing."
"Not my revelation," he said, turning to look at the candles burning on the altar. "And for your devotion you were raised high, but in your service you failed. Do not think that your service buys you more than you have already received. The reward of faith is suffering." Zelita looked up then, chains clinking as she moved.
"Is it here?"
"I watched, as I did before, even after revelation was taken from me. There have been signs in the last days. Is this the moment? Will it be here that he will rise again?" "Yes," said the man. Zelita shuddered at the word, and the chains clinked. After a second, Iacto saw tears running down her cheeks, sparkling in the candlelight. The man reached out a hand and brushed them from her face. "But there are things that must be done, prices that must be paid."
"I have always been faithful," said Zelita, still weeping. "All that can be given, I have given."
"No, you haven't. Not yet. Tell me, Bishop, what did happen to Revelation?"
"It was as I told you," she said, and there was an edge of desperation in her voice. "The scribe we used to teach her grew afraid. He started to see something in her. He vanished, and then, a little while later, so did she."
"Out of a cell no more than 20 paces from this spot, under the eyes of you and your guards, gone like a whisper."
"It was and is the truth."
He nodded once and gave a sad smile. "I know," he said. "I see it in you."
"It is happening again, isn't it? Just like when Revelation was found. The signs began, and for a moment I thought she was here again, that she had come home."
She paused, looking up at him, and then shook her head with a melody of chain links.
"There is an inquisitor called Covenant here," she said. "He has people looking through the records, looking for marks of a miracle. For a moment I thought he was one of you. He's just like..."
"I know who he is," said the man, gently. "I am here, in part, because of him." Zelita tilted her head, eyes narrowing.
"He is your enemy," she said.
"He is something that needs to be dealt with."
"But he is one of you, one of the Inquisition. You are the Emperor's chosen, his instruments."
"Naivety does not suit you, Bishop."
"Then what have I believed in all these decades? What was I doing when I lied to my brothers and sisters in faith?"
The bald man let out a breath. "Everything you have been told is a lie," he said, and knelt down so that he was face to face with the old bishop. "And all of it is true. The end of everything that has been is coming, but salvation will also come to humanity. You have helped that come to pass. That is true, Zelita, and you can believe that."
"And Covenant?"
"It is not just enemies that stand across the true path. Fools do, too." She nodded and then raised her head again.
"It will not be here, will it? He will not walk amongst us here, will he?"
The man shook his head and reached out a hand to her shoulder.
We need you to do one last service for us. It is not a small thing, and it will mark your soul with blood and suffering.
She laughed then, and lifted one of her chains of penance. The weight swung slowly on its end.
Have I ever refused such tasks?
In the shadowed recess at the back of the chapel, Iacto watched, mind racing, trying to still the thunderbeat of his heart. He was aware of the thinness of the gloom around him, of the fact that there was just shadow and air between him and what he was seeing and hearing. Iacto began to let his breath out. How was he going to get out of this? If he did, what was he going to do? His head was aching again. Nausea, bright lines coiled across his eyes.
It is supposed to be here, said the bald man softly. In this place, and at this time. The dust speaks of it, and the other portents scream it. But it is not clear. The prospect can't be picked out, so another path must be taken. If we cannot find the flower to cut, then all must know the scythe's edge.
Zelita began to shake her head.
You...
Not just I, said the man. You, Bishop. The geothermal vaults... You have the authorizing control.
You cannot...
Iacto blinked. The pain in his head was blindingly bright, and he had the sudden instinct to run, to get as far away from what he was seeing and hearing as he could.
The monastery will fall, said the bald man. Darkness has come for it in this season of night. The fire will be a mercy as much as a necessity, and mercy is a blessing in this age.
Iacto flinched before he could stop himself. His arm twitched and brushed an embroidered hanging on the wall. A ripple passed through the fabric. The man's head jerked up. His eyes swept the dark as he rose, and Iacto was running for the chapel door before he could even consider if it was a wise idea. Unseen, the man's hand flicked out. Iacto felt something hit him in the back. He ran another 2 steps, and then his legs folded as though they had been cut from underneath him. He fell, feeling coldness and lightness spread through him in the stretched time before he hit the floor. He was trying to breathe, hearing himself gasp and feeling bubbles burst in his throat. A hand gripped his shoulder and rolled him over. Iacto gasped and felt something splatter out of his mouth. The bald man looked down at him.
"Who is he?"
he said, half glancing at Zelita. Iacto gasped again.
"The abbot of one of the orders."
The bald man nodded, and then reached down next to Iacto's back, and tugged. A wet noise squelched through the air. Pain exploded inside Iacto's chest. The man held up a short throwing dagger of dark metal, with a blade that broadened near the tip. It had no tines, and the man held it loosely, as though it was a feather. Iacto tried to move, but pain and numbness were spreading through him.
"No. Don't bring yourself more pain," said the man. "What you have heard means that you must die, but you have not earned suffering."
The man leant close enough that his voice became a whisper for Iacto alone.
"Forgive me this," he said. "But salvation is always birthed in blood." And he stabbed the dagger up into Iacto's chest.
Chapter 14. The hawks glided ahead of Ninkara, wings beating silently in the ship's corridors, folding in shadow and stillness when they saw anything. It had taken time to find an officer with the correct uniform and access rings to pass through the door she needed. She had not wanted one of the von Castellan household elite. Such select groups tended to be tight, and infiltration into them took a great deal of time and delicacy, and she did not have the luxury of either. In the end, she had settled on her first-line gunnery officer of middle rank, but with the starburst crest on her chest that marked her as senior cadre amongst the middle-deck officers. That should mean she should have limited access to the command bastion. The officer had died slowly, but without pain, as the venom dart had shut down her nerve pathways one by one.
Ninkara had stripped the uniform and dumped the corpse in a crawl space. Then she had pulled the uniform over her body glove. Her shard blade had slid into her belt at the base of her back, under the uniform jacket. Her other weapons and equipment had gone into a roll made from her cloak. Hung over her shoulder on a length of cord, it looked like a kit bundle that any crewman might carry. The uniform did not fit properly, but it would pass so long as no one looked closely. So far, no one had, but that might be about to change. The door to the hoist she was making for was not guarded. She shifted her mental sight between the two hawks perched in the struts above it, and then approached. The control panel chimed as she presented the officer's ring to it. Cogwork buzzed within. A light pulsed amber. Despite herself, Ninkara held her breath. A hoist would take her up into the Dionysius command levels, just 2 decks down from the Medicaid section. If she had selected her last victim poorly, then